He was allowed in by the Castro government, along with US officials who'd once been involved in the invasion plans. It was a very strange moment for them all.
At the end of the convention itself, we sort of found common grounds between the people who fought against each other. There was sort of like a brotherhood that occurs when people who have fought against each other meet in peace and discuss what happened in those events. We finally ended up with people who had shot at each other becoming very gracious to each other and very respectful of each other, and ultimately, in some cases, even friends of each other.
In many ways, Alfredo Duran is not a typical member of that Bay of Pigs invasion force. Now in his late 70s, still living in Miami, he no longer favours regime change in Cuba by force, rather through dialogue, a position that has earned him charges of traitor from others in the exile community. But 50 years on, he is adamant that he would not do the same again.
Looking back on it, a lot of Cubans killed a lot of other Cubans. There were Cubans, we were basically brothers, and in fact there were brothers and cousins fighting each other. And if I had to do that again, I would not do it. I think that you can only accept it in the context of the time, and the context of the time was a confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States, and the whole thing that happened around the Cold War confrontations. I think that at the time, it was the thing that we had to do. If it were today, I would not do it. I would not take arms against my fellow Cubans under any circumstances.
That's the Bay of Pigs veteran Alfredo Duran. Well, Julia Swag in Washington was listening to that with me. And rickety boats, wrong beach, poor equipment, no backup. What a fiasco the Bay of Pigs was.
A massive fiasco, and one that reveals just the enormous disconnect of the time between Washington war planners and the reality on the ground on that small island nation. Yeah, I'm coming across a quote that I'll read to you. Dean Acheson, who had been Secretary of State, said to President Kennedy when they were planning the invasion. Acheson was in his 70s. Kennedy asked, what do you think about the plan? And Acheson said, are you serious? It doesn't take Price Waterhouse to figure out that 1,500 Cubans are no match for 25,000, the number of soldiers in Cuba's army. So the numbers alone were really impossible, and underestimating Fidel and underestimating the nationalism of the Cuban people. It was a total mess and a debacle, and it helped consolidate Castro in power, for sure.
So there were splits inside the Kennedy government, but that doesn't really explain why the Americans were so, if you like, shameful in abandoning the people on the beach. They gave them no follow-up, no backup.
I'm not sure it doesn't explain it. Well, you're right. The splits don't explain it. But what does explain it, perhaps, is a perennial the hubris of American foreign policy, especially in Latin America, and the fickle nature, even of the president himself, around how to deal with the fundamental asymmetry of the relationship between the United States and countries in the developing world, antagonizing adversaries, but then deploying and undeploying its own allies to make war and then produce regime change and pull them back. I mean, I think it's not an unusual circumstance. We even see much later in American history in other parts of the world where American national security planners have organized rebels to promote our foreign policy and then left them by the wayside when it failed.
Well, the Bay of Pigs was certainly one of the low points in the relationship. Julia Swag, Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, for the moment, thank you. By the way, you can listen to all our programs on Cuba, which we put into a special collection all in one place on our website. Just search for BBC Witness. More from this History Hour Cuba special in just a moment.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
It's my first time. I'm really excited. I'm nervous, though.
For 100 years, people have been crossing the USA by Greyhound bus.
Our destination of this culture will be Indianapolis, Indiana.
I'm Laura Barton, and I'll be climbing aboard for a meandering journey from Detroit to rural Kansas.
It's our job to get you safely down the road and that you have the best experience on the bus that you can have, considering that it is a bus.
Meeting my fellow travelers.
I usually sleep most of the way anyway. I sleep real good until they stop.
And listening to their stories.
That's why I love traveling Greyhound. It's like, you meet some of the best people, and some stick with you your whole life.
Greyhound 100 on the BBC World Service. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
Did you have a safe ride?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Coming up in part two of the History Hour, more key moments in relations between Cuba and the U.S., including the Cuban Missile Crisis.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States.
Also, the role of the Catholic Church will recall a historic papal visit and the murky world of U.S.-Cuban espionage. First, a World News summary.
BBC News with Charles Carroll. Elections are taking place in Liberia to elect new senators after repeated postponements, despite fears that the vote might help spread Ebola. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says the election must go ahead to avoid a constitutional crisis. 10,000 bottles of hand sanitizer have been placed at polling stations, and thousands of thermometers will be used to take voters' temperatures. President Obama has told North Korea the United States will respond to the cyber attack on Sony Pictures, which has led to the cancellation of the planned release of a film mocking the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mr. Obama said Americans could not allow dictators to start imposing censorship, and he promised that any retaliation would be proportionate. FARC rebels in Colombia have started a unilateral ceasefire. The move was announced at peace talks with the government on Wednesday. The FARC has previously announced Christmas ceasefires, but this is the first one with no end date. Pakistani security forces have attacked Pakistani Taliban positions in two separate operations near Peshawar, where the Islamist group killed nearly 150 people at an army-run school on Tuesday, mostly children. Security officials say that at least seven militants and two Pakistani soldiers were killed. The latest round of European Union sanctions on Russia comes into effect today. All investment in Crimea, the region seized by Russia from Ukraine in March, is banned, as is participation in Russian oil and gas exploration in the Black Sea. European cruise ships will not be able to visit the peninsula's ports. And China's President Xi Jinping has stressed the importance of the principle of one country, two systems during a visit to Macau, the former Portuguese colony that neighbours Hong Kong. He warned that it was important to get the balance right or it would not work. The comments will have resonance for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, which accuses Beijing of threatening the territory's autonomy. BBC News.
Welcome back to part two of the History Hour with Max Pearson, a special edition dedicated to Cuba and its rocky relationship with the USA, a relationship which, following events this past week, may now be on the mend. Still to come, we hear from a Cuban spy arrested and imprisoned by the Americans, and what role religion? We get an insight into the historic visit by the then Pope to the island in 1998. With me is Julia Swig, Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, and we'll hear from her in a moment. Let's look now, though, at perhaps the most dangerous moment in the recent history of Cuban-American relations, the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was played out in October 1962 during a 13-day confrontation between the US and the Soviet Union, teetering on the brink of nuclear war. Michael Voss has spoken to one Cuban who found himself caught up in events as the Soviet missiles were moved into place.
It's October 1962, and like many Cubans, 17-year-old William Raquip is sure he's about to go to war.
I thought, on that time, I have to fight. Something is going to happen. Maybe it's an invasion. Maybe the Americans are going to make something dirty with Cuba. I don't know. But something is going to happen. My friends, we haven't a real notion what the nuclear war could be. Because, okay, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, sounds for the Cuban like fairy tales.
William Raquip was in his final year at a Havana high school. A member of the youth militia, he was transferred to the army early that summer, where he witnessed the gradual build-up of weaponry in Cuba.
I went to a place near the Mariel Harbor. There we have a very big operation. We have to give some support and protection to some kind of cargo that is arriving to Cuba in Soviet ships.
The cargo being unloaded in secret was made up of Soviet-built ballistic missiles and nuclear warheads. And Cuba, with its deep water harbour at Mariel, right on America's doorstep, was about to find itself at the centre of the Cold War.
I remember in August and September, big things start to come from this port. Big trucks. People didn't know what inside these trucks, but people suspect, hey, there are the missiles, we have to fight, we have weapons to fight straight American. But no one, even our bosses, we never knew in that time that some of these are the warheads that were taken to Bejucal.
Bejucal, not far from Havana, is where the Soviet Union established a warehouse for the warheads. But their final destination was the far western province of Pinar del Rio, where silos and launch pads were being built. No Cubans were allowed inside the facilities, although some, like William Raquip, were assigned to help escort the convoys.
In our unit, there is a unit of the Soviet KGB. We have to follow the orders of the Soviets. I was running with the convoy in an old motorbike with I-car, but the driver was a Russian. I have the machine gun in my lap. We never know where the places are, and we never know what's happening inside.
But the build-up couldn't be kept a secret forever. On October the 14th, the U.S. spy plane was able to photograph the missile site at Las Villas in Pinar del Rio. What followed were fierce debates within the American administration over how to respond. In the end, President John F. Kennedy went on television on October the 22nd to announce a naval blockade rather than a direct strike against the missiles in Cuba.
I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
But President Kennedy maintained that he didn't hold Cubans themselves responsible.
Finally, I want to say a few words to the captive people of Cuba. I speak to you as a friend, as one who knows of your deep attachment to your fatherland. And I have watched, and the American people have watched, with deep sorrow, how your nationalist revolution was betrayed and how your fatherland fell under foreign domination. Now your leaders are no longer Cuban leaders, inspired by Cuban ideals. They are puppets and agents of an international conspiracy.
Cuba's socialist leader, Fidel Castro, meanwhile, felt that Cuba was facing a U.S. conspiracy to destroy his revolution and bring about regime change. And the previous year there'd been the disastrous U.S.-financed Bay of Pigs invasion by Cuban exiles. Fidel Castro feared another invasion was imminent. That was why he'd agreed to host the Soviet missiles. Tomas Diaz is Cuba's official historian of the missile crisis. He says Fidel Castro was not intimidated by American threats.
On the 26th, Fidel wrote to Khrushchev saying, "Don't worry about Cuba, because we are ready to resist." But he pointed out that there were indications that the U.S. would launch airstrikes, or less likely, an invasion. "If it's airstrikes, the people have the moral strength to resist," he said. "But if there's an invasion, then it will trigger a nuclear war." Fidel wasn't saying launch a nuclear bomb at the US, but rather that he was urging the use of tactical nuclear weapons.
And to show that he wasn't about to back down, Fidel Castro ordered his forces to shoot at any American planes which entered Cuban airspace.
Starting on the 24th, the Americans stepped up their reconnaissance flights as well as low-level sorties. At times, you could see them flying at 150 or 300 meters, sometimes so close you could almost see the pilot's head in the cockpit. On the 26th, Fidel ordered that the anti-aircraft battery should try to shoot them down.
One U-2 spy plane was hit, the pilot killed. For 7 days, the world seemed to be teetering on the brink of an all-out nuclear war. But after a series of secret negotiations, President Khrushchev agreed to withdraw all the missiles from Cuba in return for a public U.S. pledge not to invade the island and a private assurance that U.S. nuclear missiles, which had been sighted in Turkey, would also be removed.
President Kennedy made his announcement in a nationwide personal report to the people carried by all the major television and radio networks. Mr. Kennedy said the government had reached its conclusions regarding a Soviet withdrawal from Cuba on the basis of aerial photographs, which are to be released shortly, as well as other indications.
Cuba hadn't been consulted about the withdrawal, and Thomas Diaz says the agreement was seen as a humiliating defeat.
We heard about the deal over the radio, announcing that they had reached an agreement, and we were very indignant. Conflicts need to be resolved by negotiations, we agree, but we weren't consulted. We wanted guarantees that the U.S. would end the trade embargo, end their aggression, and return the naval base at Guantanamo Bay.
And without the Soviet missiles, William Rakib says he feared that the Russians too would withdraw, leaving the island to fend for itself.
I remember one of the Soviet officers. He was very, very, very angry about what happened. And we were angry about the decision because never took Cuba in account. Everyone knows that the hook that the Cuban Revolution had to hang on was the Russian.
William Rakib speaking to Michael Voss. Well, Julia Zweig is still with us from Washington. At the time of the missile crisis, Julia, we were all perilously close to a nuclear catastrophe, but it was essentially a US-Soviet confrontation. What impact did it have internally in Cuba?
The most important impact was the outcome. If I can just say, the mobilization on the island while the crisis was underway was profound. I remember speaking to friends who told me that they were at the time looking at their children in their cribs thinking that maybe the next day the world was going to end and that would be it. I mean, it was a very, very scary time in Cuba. In the aftermath of the agreement, there was an incredible disillusion and a sort of cold bucket of water thrown over Cuba, the realization, not just by Fidel, but across the board, that Cuba was in a way on its own, that as with the Treaty of Paris in 1898, where the Americans and the Spanish negotiated the end of the War of Independence without the independence fighters from Cuba at the table, this was repeating again. Nevertheless, the Russian relationship, the Soviet relationship with Cuba deepened in the aftermath, and the American attempt to destabilize the island continued.
That is somewhat surprising, the relationship with Russia deepening, because in a sense, not only were the Cubans on their own, they must have recognized that they were potentially going to be used as a pawn from then on.
I think they did recognize it, and I think it kind of probably made Fidel even a better strategic chess player in terms of how he managed his relationship with the Soviets and the great powers. In fact, if you just go a little bit farther into the 1970s, when Fidel decides to deploy troops into southern Africa, he doesn't do this in consultation with the Soviets. He becomes a geopolitical global player on his own without the expectation that the Soviets are going to need to be asked permission in advance.
Well, when President Obama and Raul Castro made their announcements this past week about the thaw in relations, they were keen to pay tribute to the role played by the current Pope in helping to facilitate back-channel negotiations. But Pope Francis isn't the first pontiff to have dipped his toes into these troubled waters. Back in 1998, Pope John Paul II, a man credited with having helped to bring about the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, became the first leader of the Catholic Church ever to visit the island. So what was that papal visit like? Here's Sarah Rainsford.
It is January the 21st, 1998, and a plane carrying Pope John Paul II has just touched down at Havana Airport.
Santidad Juan Pablo II,
Fidel Castro is on the tarmac to greet him.
La tierra que usted acaba de besar.
This land, which you've just kissed, is honored with your presence.
Que Cuba se abra con todas sus magníficas posibilidades.
Right from the start, I remember when he arrived, first thing he said at the airport, the arrival speech, he said the famous phrase that remained as a sort of trademark of the visit was his phrase that may the world open to Cuba and Cuba open to the world. And this is strong to say in Cuba, you see. He didn't hold back. There was no hiding, no hiding the message or trying to send any hidden signals or anything. He was quite open and he said what he thought right from the start.
Gustavo Andújar, a research chemist in a state-run institute and a devout Catholic, had been given 4 months off work to help the church with its preparations.
I was at the airport, so I saw everything from front row seat, so to speak. I was there on the tarmac, and to tell the truth, the whole 5 days went like a haze, you see. It was a sort of surreal impression that this is happening, is this really happening? I had this very strong feeling that I was a member, I was a part of something quite extraordinary, you see. Because Cuba is in many ways out of the world, you see, because of the limitations with information, access to information, and not so many people travel abroad and so on. We live very often in a sense of isolation.
It was a turbulent time after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the crumbling of the Soviet Union. Cuba was recovering from a decade of food and fuel shortages and unrest.
Ever since the fall of the wall and so on, the Cuban government has had a sort of public image problem. And I think it helped the government in a way to show that they could handle a Pope's visit in the way it was, because it was a huge success for the government, I think, to show that they could organize that in a very, receive the Pope, the man who had the reputation that he had brought down communism and so on, and they could do it in such a civilized and elegant and well done way. It was good for them, and they used the opportunity, and it came out very well.
But the relationship between Catholic Church and communist authorities here had never been easy. Gustavo remembers the darkest days just after the 1959 revolution. Cuba had been declared an atheist state.
There was a time, particularly in the early 60s, where churches were pretty much harassed. A friend of mine, a priest, that told me that he was a priest of a small town in Matanzas. And they would bring a fire truck and park it in front of the church and sound a siren all the time that the Mass was being celebrated. You see? This kind of crazy. In Cuba, all kinds of crazy things have happened.
The fact that in 1998, Fidel Castro went to meet Pope John Paul II at the airport in person was a sign of how much had changed. He even swapped his military fatigues for a suit. But Fidel hadn't always been so keen on receiving the Pope. In the early 90s, he called off one planned visit, and it was in 1996 at an audience in Rome that he was finally convinced.
The 90s were a difficult time for Marxist governments because the Berlin Wall had come down, and he was pretty much under siege by everybody. Aren't you going to make democratic changes and so on? So everybody was like harassing him with this sort of. And then he comes to Rome and visits the Pope, he had this reputation that he alone had brought down communism. And yet this man holds his hand and said, "Is this your first time in Rome?" And I think that made him an unforgettable impression. And ever since, you could notice when he spoke about John Paul, you could see the admiration, you can feel the admiration in his voice. So we knew that everything would be, it would go easily.
Outside Cuba, though, opponents of the revolution, mainly those in exile in Florida, were hoping for the opposite.
Hello, hello.
Several Cuban exile paramilitary groups are stepping up training and stockpiling weapons in the expectation that the Pope's visit will precipitate a Romanian-style revolution. Calmer voices in Miami dismiss predictions of bloody revolution, although most experts do expect the Pope to bring about some change inside Cuba.
Those still on the island, like Gustavo, were more realistic.
We didn't expect the Pope coming, changing everything overnight. But I believe that the visit did have an impact and that it did help a number of people to look at their lives, at the life of the country, at their future differently. When you live for so long in difficult conditions, difficult situation, one thing you always need is hope. Not false hope that everything will resolve somewhat magically or so, but the deep-seated conviction that things can change for the better. This is very important, and this the Pope helped. The fact that in Revolution Square we had a huge mass with true participation of it, but people were not just attending, you see, they were actually participating. And that we had, the square was presided by this huge Jesus Christ picture on the facade of the National Library. Things like that don't happen without leaving a mark. You see, in everybody's mind, it changes, it creates a clear impression that we are living a new moment, we're living a new era.
Gustavo Andújar speaking there to Sarah Rainsford. So, Julius Weig, let's talk about the role of the Vatican. In your view, given Pope John Paul II's visit and now Pope Francis's role in what has happened in the past week, how significant has the Church been?
Extremely significant. And you're correct to go back to the Pope John Paul visit. It's important to remember that in the 1990s, it wasn't just that the Vatican was playing a role externally, but that the Catholic Church internally inside of Cuba came to have more space and to work with the communist government, with the party, to get that extra space for itself and for the Cuban people. So fast forwarding, when we come up now to a Latin American Pope, Pope Francis, who understood that dynamic, who is longtime personal friends with Archbishop of Havana, Jaime Ortega, and who really had a feel for the symbolism with which Latin America as a whole regards Cuba. He, I think, was exactly the right person to embody the Vatican's history in trying to help Cuba come out into the world and vice versa, but also in order to be able to be the right interlocutor with Washington and with Havana. It's an enormously significant role that he played.
So the Church has definitely played a role in terms of helping to push towards what appears to be a rapprochement now. And the deal announced this past week involved an exchange of prisoners. On one side, two Americans, a spy, and Alan Gross, a humanitarian worker, were set free. On the other, three Cuban spies. They were part of the so-called Cuban Five, who'd originally been detained by the Americans in September 1998. Earlier this year, Mike Lanchon spoke to one of the five, René González, who was released in October 2011 after spending 13 years in an American jail. Here, González explains how he infiltrated the anti-communist Cuban exile community in Miami, which was part of his mission on behalf of the Cuban intelligence services in the U.S.
My first meeting was with an old captain from Bay of Pigs, invasion of Cuba in 1961. I remember that I was together with him in his house, and he started asking for some advice as to how to launch an airplane full of explosives against Cuba.
It was like a first test of whose side González was really on. Then came another test, the following day, at a meeting of one of the exile groups.
As I walk into the room, the first guy that is introduced to me is the assassin of Che Guevara. Meet here Felix Rodriguez El Gato. He's the guy who killed Che Guevara. And the guy extend his hand to me, and I don't know how I did it, but I just took his hand and I shook it, and said a couple of complimentary things to him. For me, it was like a test, because then I turned back when I went to my house, and then I realized that I was able to comply with that mission.
René González soon became a trusted member of the anti-Castro movement. His wife and children joined him in America, and he began flying missions for Brothers to the Rescue, an exile group that helped Cubans flee across the Florida Straits and dropped anti-government leaflets onto the island. But all along, González was leading a double life, passing information to his Cuban government handler.
We had that in common with the FBI. We all meet on fast food places, you know. It's not like in a cave or something like that.
So you would meet in fast food places because those were quite public?
Yes, yes. Just having a normal conversation. It's not like in the movies that you're going to pass some sophisticated thing to somebody, or it wasn't like that.
In personal terms, how difficult was it to maintain this double life?
You have to deal with it, and I believe that you get used to it. I wouldn't look at most of the people who I dealt with as personal enemies. Some of the people who belong to those organizations, they weren't bad people, so I really, on a personal level, has some real rapport with them and consider them friends.
René González, former Cuban spy. So, Julius Weig, finally, let's try to pull some of these threads from history together and actually tie them into the rapprochement between Havana and Washington, which was announced in the past week. Given the history of the enmity between the two countries, can that relationship be healed? And the other element to this is, how far will change internally in Cuba go?
You know, we've been at this for 50 years with one another, and that doesn't include the pre-1959 tensions. So I think it's very important to recognize that this is a first step, that the cultural and social and economic and political ties that may now well develop will not overnight undo the skepticism and the mistrust and the very bad habits that both governments have adopted and adapted. It will take some time. I like to think of this about as becoming a more natural relationship, because frankly, I'm not sure what normal looks like between the United States and Cuba, but we can make it more natural. As far as the internal, this is an enormously significant moment, because Cuba itself internally is in a fluid process of molting, if you will. The reform process that Raul Castro launched about 6 years ago has gone in some sense quite slowly, but in some sense against the backdrop of 50 years of a one-party dominant state, closed economy and society, it's gone rather quickly. And the Cuban people are enormously excited about this moment. This is going to be very popular on the island, and the more the natural ties of what President McKinley called singular intimacy between the two countries can unfold, the more I think the politics in both countries around how we relate to one another will change and will become more moderate.
Yeah, it's really all about the internals, isn't it? Because if political freedom and economic opportunity don't develop, don't materialize in Cuba, then restoring diplomatic relations really is irrelevant.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. The diplomatic relations are a formal and symbolic way of stating to both societies, look, we're going to undertake a big change. But the real issue is, of course, the impact not only inside of Cuba, but inside of the United States. And the dynamic is such that we do really affect one another. We're so close, and we've been so involved with one another's domestic politics for so long. That will just continue.
So it's not the end of history, but it's perhaps the end of a chapter in the history of the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. Julia Zweig, I'm very grateful to you. She's Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Her book on the subject pretty much sums it up: Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. And with one of the great fault lines of 20th century history showing signs of being resolved, that's it for this special edition of the History Hour. There will be our usual more eclectic mix of recollections in next week's programme, although there will be a bit of a Christmassy feel. I do hope you'll join me again then. This is Max Pearson. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Hey, hey, mister, won't you tell me your name? I have nothing and I'll give you the same. Hey, hey, miss. tell me your name? I am no one and I expect the same. You're not alone. You're not alone. You're not alone. It's the seed you sow. You're not alone. You're not alone. You're not alone. In the seed you sow. Hey, hey, sister, why you looking away? I have nothing and I'll give you the same.
der Kraft ein neuer Tag schwingt Rhythmus in die Hitten der Stadt. Man sieht und kennt und sagt sich, was diese Nacht zu sagen hat. Fragt Lust nach neuen, alten Werten. Seht, was es nicht zählt, nur ein Gefühl. Die Nacht gehört uns bis zum Morgen. Wir spielen jedes Spiel. Lass diese Reise niemals enden. Das Tun kommt aus dem Sein, allein. Allein als Immersionen, die Illusionen und Sensationen lohnen.
Genau.
Junge Räume tanzen anders als die anderen. Rest der Welt. Frag junge Römer, erkennt ihr die Sonne noch? Sie kennt die Sorgen. Junge Römer, die Nacht ist jung wie ihr, vergesst das Morgen. Und mal ein nuovo porta, ritmo nei fianchi della città. Vediamo, troviamo, chiediamo che cosa si fa. Ma non cercate dei valori e magari sensazione. La notte nostra fino al mattino. Abbiamo illusione, non è la fine del viaggino. C'è sempre domani e ci sono dimensioni con illusioni e sensazioni.
Yeah.